Hello, Steven here. I'm happy to present to you an episode that has been a long time in the making. For today, we go where we have never gone before, into the little-known realm of contemporary Christian techno-thrillers. We are serving up all the finest moral critiques of genomic and reproductive sciences religious reactionaries from 1996 have to offer. Please join us as we explore the world of Albertan author Sigmund Brouwer's schlocky diatribe, Double Helix. Now, as you may expect, our discussion of this book involves matters related to reproductive rights and sexual violence. Please be advised. On a personal note, I'd like to thank you all for your patience and forbearance. It's been a while getting this episode out. We are here, we're still around, and we'll be continuing to put out episodes forthwith. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Have a happy holiday. I'm Steve.
And with us today, our recurring co-host guest,
our specialist, our scientist in residence, biologist in residence, Candace.
Hello.
Today we are talking about a childhood favorite.
No.
Whoever had this book as their favorite as a child needs some therapy right now.
I mean, I don't know. I thought I was suggested to read this book. Coerced to read this book because it was a favorite of somebody when they were a kid.
No, I read this book when I was in high school, but I knew the author. I didn't know the author. I read a lot of books by this author as a young adult, well, as a young teenager.
Right.
Because he writes more like children/young teenager books. And then this, he kind of was exploring his range in the 90s and wrote a bunch of other...
The author is obviously Central Albertan Sigmund Brouwer.
Obvious.
But in this book, he's writing as Tom Clancy, so it's a treat.
His publisher said, give me your best Tom Clancy impression. Done.
I will say that this episode does contain spoilers for the 1996 book Double Helix by Sigmund Brouwer. So look out. You have 21 years to read.
This is
22 years to read the book, and that is all.
As Candace was saying, this is one of Sigmund Brouwer's adult books. Sigmund Brouwer is he's an author who lives in Red Deer. He has over 4 million copies of his books in print.
He writes 4 million books.
He does have a lot of books.
He is prolific.
He writes across genres. He's got the children's picture books, this scientific thriller that we read, young adult books, like children's books, picture books.
Sigmund Brouwer, as I knew him, was the guy who wrote authorized novelizations of like semi-pro Western Hockey League teams. So he wrote like authorized novelizations about the Red Deer Rebels, which is like, yeah. And it was like WLGL authorized.
Next time, if you can, we'll be doing an entire series about Sigmund Brouwer's.
It's not really in our scope, I don't think.
That's fair.
I think his first books that he wrote, or some of his earliest books, were called The Accidental Detectives. And those are the ones that I was exposed to as a child. I grew up on a Bible college campus, and those were one of the few safe reading materials that you could buy at the Christian bookstore. So then when we moved to Red Deer, I was, and I found out that Sigmund Brouwer was from there. That was very exciting for me.
He'd been reading his work for years. Yeah, he did a short series, and it was down to doing Double Helix or doing one of these books about, like, people who live in like a post-apocalyptic, like
world. CyberQuest.
CyberQuest, yeah. We live in this post-apocalyptic world, but time travel back to biblical events. so, yeah, it's like cyberpunk meets Bible trivia. It's real awesome. We'll get to it one day,
it's,
maybe.
It's like post-water wars.
Yeah, there was a war for water.
Yeah.
Of course. Of course.
And somehow someone created technology where you could go back in time, and for some reason they go back into the time of Jesus.
Well, if you could go back to any time, wouldn't you choose the time of Jesus?
To prevent the water wars?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, probably.
That's the most practical solution.
Anyway, but we are not talking about CyberQuest. We are talking about Double Helix.
So, Sigmund Brouwer, he's a minor Red Deer celebrity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He also lives in Nashville.
Yeah, now. He's married to a...
I would say he's more than a minor celebrity in the Christian fiction world.
To be fair, I have never heard of him until you guys said, hey, read this book.
Yeah, because that was in Saskatchewan where I grew up that I heard of him. Right. So I think he's, you know, he's permeated the Christian
literature. So that minor celebrity definitely has an asterisk beside
yes.
it.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, this book comes to us actually secondhand from a Florida bookstore. So he obviously has, I think he has penetration into the United States in the contemporary Christian literature market.
There seems to be a subtext in that Candace was exposed to these books.
I know.
He has penetration.
These are the words you use to describe marketing.
Did you guys read that like one really kind of rapey scene where he injects stuff into the zygote? That was pretty, yeah. It was pretty sexual.
Well, I think this is really where the book. Now that we're talking about like gross rape scenes, I think we can kind of launch into the foreword to this book or the prologue.
Well, I wanted to read the description that made us decide to read this book instead of CyberQuest.
Of course, yes, please do.
I can't find the full one that was so good, so I'll just read the little one to give you a taste of what you're in for. Slater Ellis is in the race against time, a hitman and a professor who plays God in his spare time. The results are a showdown with stakes no less than the future of the human race.
Okay, you were eager to talk about the book.
I was eager to talk about the book. So this book basically starts in an operating theater, a woman chained down, forced in labor. Yeah.
Is she chained down during her labor?
I think she's...
I know the bad guy. Van Cleese. This is where we are introduced to him, right?
Yeah.
She's in active labor, like pushing, literally pushing. And he's like, shut her up, shove a cloth in her mouth. You know, like, I can't believe she's being so noisy. And that's kind of how we're...
Child's thetans will be all off.
We later find out that he's like impregnated her. Like he is solely responsible for everything up until this point. And he's like, shut up, woman. You're just having a baby.
This woman is also, this book also takes time to tell us that this woman is black.
Yes.
Yeah. And then she, you know, in all the midst of all these horrors, then she eventually gives birth to a stillborn child.
Deformed stillborn child.
Who is, and I think the book takes time to tell us this, white.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's where this book really starts.
And then, but because she, like, sees the stillborn child.
Oh, yeah.
And he's so horrified, then he has to kill her.
Yeah, for whatever reason.
Because she saw the child.
So it basically starts with the...
That's how it starts.
Yeah, with the birth of a stillborn child and then a homicide. Yeah. Completely, just without context, you just know
that's
that
the prologue.
Yeah, that's the prologue, and then we're thrown into and we smash cut to a suburban home in the dead of night. We meet Paige Stevens.
Paige Stevens, who is trying to kind of break down this emotional wall that her husband has erected by creating a sexy romantic evening.
Yeah, with Paige Stevens in her red negligee, thinking her very womanly thoughts about her marriage. And
about how sexy she looks.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And that if her husband isn't having sex with her, he's probably having sex with someone else.
Yes.
And she just needs to be more attractive.
That's why there's this emotional distance between them, because he's having an affair.
So she hears him on the phone, so she listens in to get details about her husband's sordid affair, and overhears him being blackmailed and then subsequently kill himself. And her thought to this is, oh, gee, I guess he wasn't cheating on me after all. Thank God. What a relief.
It wasn't another woman. Well, to be fair, that's her thought after the phone conversation.
Yes.
And then he goes and kills himself. Yeah.
And she thinks, oh, darn. Could I have done something sooner to stop this?
Yeah. Does she? I don't think we really know what she thinks after that because, you know.
Well, I mean, she does stop thinking.
Yeah.
She's just in shock.
Right.
And she doesn't know.
Yeah.
And the next time we see Paige, it continues on in that vein where she's just like, I don't know what to do. Find a realtor and sell the house. I don't even care. Don't tell me anything. I just...
Hysterical.
I'm so distraught.
But she wants to sell the house because it was, like, ransacked. Went in and was, like, looking for
something. Yeah, during the funeral or something.
She wants to get out of there and kind of...
She knows something weird is going on for sure, but...
That's when the policeman was hitting on her.
Yes.
And she was like...
Yeah, that's right.
Ooh, I am still sexy. Still got it.
Yeah, but he was a super creep.
He was super creepy. But she was kind of flattered by it.
Was she? I thought she was really upset by it. And that's because there was two points.
She was upset, but she was like...
She was like where it talks about her kind of being empowered to be really catty. And she's like kind of a bitch to him. And it talks about how that's really empowering. And then the next day she goes to visit her husband's office and is kind of a bitch to his secretary, who she thought he was having the affair with. And she...
Yeah, and she's still on about that, even though she like absolutely categorically knows that it was all to do with...
Yeah.
Being blackmailed and this conspiracy.
But because the secretary like kind of dresses suggestively and like leans and shows cleavage, she's...
You wore that dress when I was here before, didn't you? Of course, it looks so good. I can see why you'd want to wear it as much as possible.
Yeah, but... Yeah.
Never mind that, like, in the meanwhile, like, very clearly she's in the middle of a conspiracy that she knows nothing about and
that's
fears
why
for
she
her
goes,
life.
She goes to the office, right, to try and find any information.
But very clearly feels that it's a priority to be a huge bitch to this woman.
Yeah.
Knows nothing, has been involved in no way. So.
And that's when she meets her husband's boss, whose name is what?
John Hammond.
John Hammond.
No, John Hammond's the Jurassic Park.
Isn't it? I thought it was a Hammond.
Mr. Hammond.
Oh, yeah, it's John Hammond. Okay. Is that Jurassic Park then? Anyway, John Hammond. And it's interesting because here we get, there is an economics note. Paige tells us about like the structure of the company, which is a charity called the International World Relief Council, and the structure of this is actually he's supposedly a great millionaire who then donated money, but he didn't. We learned that he didn't donate any money that goes to world relief. He only donated to finance the bureaucracy that solicits funds, and that actually he made so much money in tax breaks that he came out ahead from starting his charity. So we know he's a smart businessman. And that's how we're introduced to him.
And that's how you also know that he's, like, so ethical. You know,
he's such an excellent steward. There's your first Christian buzzword of the night. He's such a good steward of the resources that he doesn't actually... You know, he makes in his giving generates new revenue. Of course, you don't realize that's from evading... That's from not paying taxes, so it's not really making money. But anyway, it gets in this whole assumption about what is good money management and what is intelligent behavior, and intelligent behavior is by using your money not to support charities and not to go to the public good in the form of taxes, but in the creation of reams and reams of bureaucracy and middle management. So good, glad we know that now. Thanks, Sigmund Brouwer.
The description of that. So I've got it all.
He's taking money from his profit.
Yeah, that down there, yeah.
No, he's New York real estate tycoon. He's kind of Trump. I thought that at first. Are we going to have a Trump? But
most of the Sigmund in a little bit. Gone into hiring the best people from the private sector.
Boo!
Yeah. And he gave them higher salaries than the private sector.
Yeah, because a higher salary... automatically means that you're able to get more money from other people. You're a better fundraiser if you get paid better.
Yes.
That's a fact.
Science. Management science.
So she meets this guy.
Yeah.
The head of this organization.
Yeah, who takes her out for dinner.
And he's very, what he likes to very do, charming. And he has a great smile.
Yes. And she just thinks, this guy is a catch for someone. I mean, obviously not me, because my husband just died, but he's pretty sexy.
If my husband hadn't just died and I wasn't married,
I would marry him and have conjugal love with him.
yeah, so then John flirts with her a lot.
Yeah.
Says, like, and they keep in touch. But yeah. I'll be in touch with you because even though I'm very busy and very important, you are also important. And mm-hmm. I feel bad for what happened to you and your husband.
Your husband was a good guy.
To which the very womanly Paige Stevens is just, ooh, okay, this is so nice. People are so nice to me. Nothing is wrong.
Anyway, and so and she sells her house. And
puts her house up for sale.
Puts her house up for sale.
Because that's important later.
And goes to visit this
lawyer.
She goes
to Florida because
the International World Relief Council is in Florida. That's where the headquarters. I don't know where.
No. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it's in Tampa.
I don't. It's in Tampa. And this is what's weird. I don't know how the company her husband works for is not in the city where she lives. This is what's.
Maybe he didn't have to work in the headquarters. I mean, he's only a money man.
That's true.
Yeah.
He's a scientist.
No, he was the.
Okay, right. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. My apologies. But anyway, also
he cooked the books.
He cooked the books for the institute. Oh no! Spoilers.
if you hadn't put that together yet.
He just killed himself for no reason.
Yeah, so we also, but here we also get to meet, but while all this is going on, we're kind of smash cutting back, we're cutting back and forth between Van Cleese, the evil man we met from the prologue, and his henchman, Svan, who is, I guess, Eastern European, but he really draws we do learn that his superpower is memorizing phone numbers. Marshall, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I think he's on the phone with Van Cleese, and Van Cleese says something about, here's an address that you need to go to, and here's the phone number to reach somebody. And they make a special note to say, Svan would of course remember both of these things perfectly, and could recall them for several years, because he has such a good memory, even though he'd only heard it once, and he'd been distracted at the time. What the hell?
I actually don't remember that line at all. I glossed right over that.
Yeah. It just caught me off guard because it was like...
So specific.
Well, very specific and really like the human brain is really only good at remembering like 7 digits at a time.
But we also learned that Svan derives his great evil nature from the fact that he is physically deformed. He's a burn victim or something. And so because he is so ugly on the outside, his resentment towards all the beautiful people has turned him evil, which is
also buff.
Oh.
Yeah, he's like really big.
Oh, also really strong.
And strong.
And he's ripped.
Yeah.
Everything else about him indicates that he's actually not that intelligent, except this amazing superpower for remembering numbers, which I totally
missed.
But
we're told that he's smart, and we never see him do a smart thing.
He smashes people's toes with sledgehammers.
We also hear all the time about how smart Van Cleese is. and he never once behaves.
Well, his superpower is taking people out to dinner.
Yes, it is. Yes, because when we meet Van Cleese again, he's taking a young scientist, a PhD candidate, out for dinner, and his internal monologue is just ridiculous. Because like, yes, I have you right where I want you now.
Oh no, he's catching on. Give him a smile. Smile at him.
Smile at him.
A person who
has to think about when to smile is a master. Really organic.
I really looked forward to the Van Cleese segments because he's like maybe the funniest character I've ever encountered in literature.
Not intentionally.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
I laughed out loud like virtually every scene he was in. It was at his internal dialogue.
Well,
he's taking
this guy out to dinner for a job interview and he says, yes, this poor simpleton believes he's in this job interview is a job interview. The fool.
And then he gets... toward the end of the dinner, and this poor schmuck who can't eat because he's gotten food on his fingers or something, and now he's having dessert and smacking his lips. You know, like a human who's eating. I don't know.
Von Cleese
very weird.
Von Cleese, normal human man.
You wrote that at one point in the book. Yes. I came across that, and that made me laugh.
And Von Cleese suggests that maybe... in the pursuit of science, this scientist might have to do something immoral. I think he's pretty vague about what it is, but he's like, you know, when you're doing science-y stuff and you come up against your morals, you throw your morals out the window and keep doing science-y stuff, right? And the PhD's like,
No.
And Von Cleese makes the snap decision right then to not only not hire him, but also to kill him?
Yeah. He knows too much. He knows about the dinner plan.
He knows that I interviewed him for a job. Damn it. I can't tell him no. As if this PhD candidate probably hasn't had dozens of dinners and been told no dozens of times. He works in academia.
I mean, Van Cleese is kind of, I think Van Cleese is kind of like a pickup artist guy. Like, he's kind of like, yes, I'm going to manipulate you. And he's like, and he's just, so you'll do what I want, right? I bought you dinner. Like, no, and it's like, oh, fuck, I'll kill you now. Like,
he just really likes killing people. He's just like really. Just,
Yeah. He was an incel before there were incels.
So after that, after he has that dinner, he's like really mad because his minion, he calls him my servant.
This guy he took to dinner.
No, it's Vaughn. Vaughn. Because Vaughn was supposed to kind of scout him out ahead of time and make sure he was appropriate. And he wasn't. So then he's after that, he's walking her through this park and he's like really mad.
Don't fail me again.
And just, I have to read this. An old lady walking a poodle approached. Van Cleese resisted the urge to kick the poodle into the waters of the fountain. Intellectual pride or not, he understood the value of venting emotion and had no trouble indulging himself when convenient. Like, well, the restraint for just, like, not kicking somebody's dog.
Clearly, remember, don't kick the dog. Paige will think you're a psychopath.
Remember to smile. Don't kick the dog.
Who is this person? Yeah, I have to remind myself not to kick dogs.
These are like sub vocalizations that Von Cleese has on a regular basis. That is supposed to be like the greatest manipulator who has everyone.
Normal evil genius type thing. Yeah, don't kick the dog. Don't kick the dog. Don't kick the dog. Don't kick the dog.
That's just like random nonsense going on in the side. We also learned that, like, I guess apparently they're trying to get a liver for a general, but that really, none of that really matters because then we cut to.
We should talk about Slater Ellis, yeah. Who is the only person described in the description of the book, kind of shares the spotlight with a lot of. So we're
Slater Ellis is our hero.
Yes. Yeah.
He's driving a Jeep or something like that through the mountains SUV. Late at night. Full of groceries in the back.
It's a Nissan X-Terra.
Sure, yeah. And
they do actually tell you what...
I think
it's
so.
It's like a new kind of truck.
Yeah, anyway.
It's, yeah.
He does use late model a lot of times in the book. It was one of the words... It was a late model Ford or a late model pickup truck. You're like, why late... did he want this book to remain timely?
Maybe.
Rather than giving the date of the vehicle, and that would date the book, I'll just say late model.
So... Yeah, he says that late model in order to not date the book, but it's set in a time where people have cell phones, but the internet is dial-up and it's still cassette players in vehicles.
Like, they have cell phones, but they're like the bag phone?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
It's really cool that Slater has a phone and he goes on the internet, but we'll get
into
that
the
later.
Internet is like a new thing.
But yeah, Slater's driving and he sees something weird.
A naked child.
So he obviously he's a good guy. He pulls over to help the kid.
See a naked kid, you pull over and you walk into the
chase him into the woods.
And then the kid runs away. Because when you're a naked kid and a man gets out of the car and starts walking toward you, you run away.
Yeah. And then they throw a rock at him and cut his
Naked child.
Yeah, he saw a naked child.
And then he gets knocked out by this super kid.
Right.
He runs away, and now his heart's palpitating in fear, and he's running, and he's running, and he looks back, and the kid's still there, and he looks back, and the kid's still there, and he's almost to the truck, and something comes flying through the air, and bam. Slater Ellis. Last thing he sees is some kid, naked kid, standing over him.
Yeah. He's knocked out. Unconscious. So then he reports this incident to the local police.
Waking up the next morning, he has no clothes on except for his boxer shorts.
Yeah. And his truck is still there.
Which are
white with red hearts on them.
Cash... Still in his wallet, but the food is gone. Fresh food is gone. Canned food still there.
So then he goes to the hospital because he's got some get some stitches in his head and phones the police from there and lies about his location, what he saw. And so he wants them to investigate the kids, but he doesn't want to be connected with it at all for some reason, which we don't find out until later.
That's when we find out that the sheriff's office that he phoned has a sheriff who is also in the pay of the Institute. Jvon has already paid him a visit and said, you do what we tell you to do when we tell you to do it. And also, every time I phone you, you're going to give me the last four digits of your phone number.
This is where we find out that their super secret code for their agents is the last four digits of their phone numbers. Because that is an unbreakable.
Zvon will phone and say, my number is 7823. And the sheriff, Dell, will say, my number is 4844. And they're like, oh, yeah, no, definitely has to be the right guy. He knows the phone number.
Yeah, he knew his own phone number.
I mean,
because no one else would know the phone number that you're reaching them at, ever.
Yeah, so do we learn, yeah, he and here we see Dell leaping into action, listening to the recording, the 911 call or whatever, and you doing some great top-tier detective work in which he listens and he says, well, based on the guy's diction and way of speaking, I assume he's white and probably, you know, well-educated and wealthy. So it's very unlikely he is going to commit a crime. So nothing to see here. Moving
on. No Latin accent, so...
Well, yeah, except not nothing to see here, because he's been commissioned to track him down and make sure that he doesn't know anything.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Because these boys are connected to the Institute.
Somehow.
But... Dell didn't know they were connected. He was just like had a hunch, and he was like,
"No, because they didn't they phone him once they when they escaped." So he knew to look out for that.
Oh, maybe I thought he phoned Zvon and said some guy called, and there was like some naked kid.
No, Zvon phoned because they're close. The town was close to the Institute. So then, when the kids escaped, then he phoned him and primed him to be on the watch.
Right.
Yeah.
But he assesses that Slater Ellis is just a bystander and not a criminal element based on his and class.
They have traced
straight up detective work.
The location of his call, and he did, and the fact that he lied about his call makes him kind of suspicious. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because they check his Dell's wife is a nurse in the hospital, so he gets her to check all of the records of anybody who was in the hospital around the time of the call, and he finds that there was like a list of only 12 people that it could have been, and then Slater's name comes up, and then he's like, oh, Slater, that guy again? Suspicious.
Well, this is the first time he, because he gave a fake name.
Yeah, somehow, I can't remember through the detective work, but eventually, like...
Because he gave his address as Montana, and then he runs his plates or something and finds out that he's not there, that he's actually local, and that's when he's like, oh, that's what it's this guy.
Must be this guy who lied to me.
Yeah.
He probably has kidnapped these kids.
Well.
He makes a lot of leaps.
No, he probably is the guy who made the phone call that I'm supposed to get rid of because he knows too much now because he saw kids
He saw
woods.
A naked kid. Well, I should kill him.
Well, there's water in soup, and ramen is a type of soup, and Brittany Murphy was in the movie The Ramen Girl, and she died of anorexia. Oh, my God. Food.
So, meanwhile, Dell's investigating Slater. Slater,
it makes no sense, okay?
Slater is setting a trap to lure a child.
Because he knows that obviously these kids are still around.
Well, he found out, his neighbor came to visit.
His neighbor came to visit.
And said that some of our laundry was stolen off the line, and his wife,
in particular, his wife's underwear,
thought it was Slater that was, stealing ladies' underwear to be...
This is also where Sigmund Brower goes into great detail to describe how grotesquely fat this lady is, and isn't that disgusting, and couldn't her underwear be the sail on a ship?
Yes, he uses this lady's weight as a jumping off point for just like lots of fat jokes. Fat joke after fat joke.
How she's a bad person, how if you let her, she'd eat the whole pie.
Her poor husband. He has so much sympathy for her husband, and she's just...
Well, if you had to put up with that kind of a lady all the time, fat... And she nags you? Jeez. Sigmund Brower really does not like women.
No. And
he doesn't like fat people. I think he has like a fear. Yeah. I think he must have some weight issues. Because
I mean, if you look at pictures of him, his weight fluctuates over the years. You know, he does.
Here we go.
Bigger and thinner.
Did the thief,
not ever really big. But
did the thief need an emergency tent and her undies seemed about the right size? That's one of them.
God.
Yeah, we get it. You had to. Great. And then when she comes to visit, the neighbors come to visit together. Slater glanced at the station wagon to measure Joyce's progress. Joyce is this, really fat lady. She had finally made it out of the car and was bending through the rear door into the back seat. To Slater, it looked like a tight squeeze, and her pink dress could have been a curtain coming down on a play. Also, just bad writing. He fought any conjecture about her underwear billowing on the clothesline like a mainsail. Joyce, this is then a little while later, he looks out again, and Joyce was still struggling to pull herself from the backseat of the car. Slater assumed when she finally did, she'd be holding a pie. And then she's walking up to the house. The woman did make plenty of shadow. We get it. She... Okay. And then when he reached the porch, he discovered she was tall too. Nearly as tall as he was. Poorly dyed blonde hair and greasy skin gave Slater a whole new sympathy for her, this woman's husband. Just like, she's a disgusting human being. Mm-hmm. She's just like, so she's ugly and fat. And then you find out later she's like a busybody and really nosy, and he just like created this character that is disgusting.
There's also some NRA agenda in there too, like a little bit like, because doesn't the neighbor talk about like getting their gun and like lying in wait for the people who are stealing stuff up from their yard to like shoot
Well,
them?
The first time that the neighbor came to visit, he
had his gun.
Yes, yeah. Later came home and he found the neighbor sitting on his porch with a shotgun.
Yeah, defending, got to defend my wife's underwear. Like, that's a reasonable thing to shoot someone over.
Yeah, and so then Slater Ellis tells some lies, disarms the situation, and then the husband admits that bringing the shotgun was really his wife's idea.
Yeah, because she's...
Because I'm a rational person. I would never have brought a gun here, but my wife, you know how she is.
All women are hysterical, you know.
Also, that it's inconceivable that anyone could have any kind of, like, fetish for a woman who's overweight. You know? Like, no. That she's just... She is not...
You have the internet, Slater.
Or, like, could possibly find someone that's overweight attractive in any way. Like, you don't... I don't know why I said fetish. Like...
Yeah.
Just, like, a regular human person might be attracted to another regular human person.
Yeah. Whoa. Whoa. Oh, God.
We also, so then Slater, because he's super clever, says, oh, people stealing clothes? My clothes were stolen by these children. Probably those children are still, or that child is still around. That child is probably stealing clothes.
In his mind, he makes these connections. Uh-huh. But he doesn't tell
tell anybody.
He tells them because, he had stuff stolen too, though.
Yeah, exactly. So more lies. And then this is when he puts the plan together. Well, if this kid is out stealing clothes, I should steal that kid.
Yeah, I should lure him in and kidnap him.
Yeah.
Because...
It's the responsible thing to do.
And here's the thing that I found I struggled with. Like, what is his motivation at all? And finally, after he kidnaps the kids, it comes out that this project of kidnapping children and seeing what happened from there gave his life a purpose. That's literally what it says.
I was pretty rich and
bored. And that
comes
up a couple times, yeah. Oh, like this saving people, kidnapping children, and then later on when he goes to save some people, like, he felt that purpose. Like, oh, okay.
Well, I mean, he does spend his life trying to hide from everyone, so I can see why he would need some purpose. It's just sad that he only found it by kidnapping children.
Yeah.
So he basically rigs up like a trip with his garage door, so it will, like, when someone goes in, it will trip wire, and then it will slam the garage door shut.
And his bait is?
I really found it fascinating the way it was described that, like, he...
So much detail on building this trap.
Yeah,
for this kid.
So, like, and he bought all this wood, and then he did a whole bunch of carpentry work, and he put out blackout blinds on all of the windows in the garage, and then he slatted up all of the windows, and then he built a mechanism out of the door so that, like, the walking door, not the garage door itself, so that it could only open so far, so that he could open it and look inside, but nothing else could open the door completely. And then he built the garage door to, like, slam closed and be super heavy so that no one, not even him, could lift it.
Yeah, he took it off of the automatic thing. Yeah. Yeah, it's very detailed.
He knows so much detail.
At one point, he's even talking about, like, different types of, like, bonds, like, different things using tying them up and how to tie them
up
tightly.
I think that was a different character.
It's later, because he's talking about how, like, oh, I have to use this kind of material so that way, like, I can tie them up tightly, but it won't leave marks.
No, I thought that was Vaughn. I'm pretty sure that's, like, a Zavon.
Anyway, the fact that Sigmund Brower knows a lot about tying people up anyway and confining them in spaces.
Yeah. Trapping,
I don't know. That's an interesting skill set you've got there, Sigmund Brower.
So then, both as decoy and as bait,
he uses two golden retriever puppies which he hangs in like a hammock so they can't escape, and that and they're kind of at the back of his garage to lure the child.
What boy wouldn't be drawn to puppies?
Yeah. Yeah.
Once these puppies start howling in the middle of the night, that kid is going to be definitely drawn here.
Yeah.
For sure we'll walk into a pitch dark garage to get puppies.
This is like, I feel like this is a plan on Van Cleef's level.
Yeah. it's a Van Cleef plan.
It is. Yeah. No, yeah, because it's super genius.
I found a lot of parallels between Slater and Van Cleef. They were very similar characters in my mind.
I really thought there was only like three characters in the book. There was like Van Cleef Slater, who were like two sides of a coin.
Yeah.
And then there was like Jvon Dell, who were the same like enforcer character. And then there was Paige.
Yeah.
Womanly women.
And I guess Dell's wife was kind of the similar.
Also a womanly woman. Because
she was also described as being really sexy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. She was super sexy. Dell was always into her.
Yeah.
And again, very dutiful, loyal wife, you know, and doesn't have her own thoughts or contradicting opinions.
Well, until she was shown the pictures of him participating in a massacre, and then she was like, I'll get back at him by never talking to him about this, never leaving him, and only reporting to a shadowy figure everything that he does.
So to get back to Van Cleef, because at this point we really have no idea what's going on at all. We know that, okay, so...
Van Cleef does some science, I guess.
Slater traps this kid, which ends up being three identical boys
with
numbers tattooed on their heads. Do you remember what the numbers are?
Five. They're not sequential.
No, they're like one is like 30 and one is 11 and
I think is important
at the end. That's why I think it's important to mention which numbers they are. But they're not. Yeah, they're not John, sequential.
One's called John. One's called 3. And one's called 16. That's how ham-fisted some of these allegories are. But anyway.
Yeah, so they have numbers on their tattooed on their foreheads. Meanwhile, Van Cleef is off doing science.
Do you want to talk about the science Van Cleef is doing?
Yeah, so you find out, he's a professor. He's a professor at a university. I don't know if we ever know which one. And then one of his alter egos is the head of...
Technogen,
yeah.
Yeah, a large genetics company.
Yeah, who make their money by selling aborted baby parts.
Yeah, so when you take aborted baby parts and you culture them inside rodents?
Well, no, they provide a service of like connecting researchers with... they go to abortion clinics and like collect all of the stem baby cells. Parts and then... But that they also do research. But he says that this is used for, he called it fetal transplantation, which is where you just implant fetal tissues into animals, which I mean, I've never heard of this. It might be a thing, but I don't know.
It seems crazy.
And while he's talking about this, he talks about how it's better if you can like harvest living fetuses is what they... like to try and do, because then they're like intact and it's just like really anything that you could think of as like the most cartoonish evil evil.
It sounds like a Christian, it sounds like things I heard about abortion at like Christian summer camp, you know, like they take the fetus parts and then they sell them to companies. Yeah. Well, it's alive and it's in great
pain.
And
then they cut it up.
Yeah.
And well, it's alive.
Like butchers on a cutting board and sell it to companies for... to make evil things.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's basically what Technogen is, arbitrary.
Yeah, and he's the head of that. Evil. And then he's also a professor at a university, and then he's also in charge of the institute.
So, yeah, he runs this shadowy...
Yes, and I think the science scenes in the book are at the institute, but it's not really clear.
Yeah. So Van Cleef is a guy with three full-time jobs, two of them very public, to which he pretends to be two different people, though. Right? Or is he...
Three. Because...
Oh, yeah.
Because what we haven't found out yet is that John Hammond is also Van Cleef. So he's also in charge of that charity.
Yeah, the International
Relief. And actually, they're using that charity to kidnap people from war-torn countries.
Rwanda specifically.
Yeah.
Because it's 1996.
Women,
so
yeah.
That's
and
topical.
Before that, it was Bosnia.
Yeah. Again, topical.
So, yeah. So they're kidnapping women from these countries and using them to implant their, like, he's doing genetic research on embryos. And they're implanting them into these women.
But to do that, he needs to implant them in women and carry them to term.
Yes. And that's what he's doing at the Institute. So there's a couple of scenes of him doing science at the Institute where he is injecting restriction enzymes into a zygote. And that's the description. That's like the whole description of what's going on in the scene.
So as a biologist with some background in genetics, could you explain to us what would be the net result of injecting some restriction enzymes into a zygote?
All that would do is it would cut up the DNA in the nucleus. That's what basically all the description indicates
as
that he
described.
Just as it's described. And he describes restriction enzymes correctly as kind of like DNA scissors, right? So he just basically injects these DNA scissors into the zygote. And that's all the information that we're given. But later
he just lyses
based
the chromosomes.
On, yeah. Based on context later, we're able to understand that he then is just like randomly inserting DNA into these spots that he then opened up in the.
Well, because he does say the second advance was a technique that allowed pieces of DNA to mindlessly replicate again and again and again.
PCR.
It gave scientists an easy supply of material to paste back into an unzipped portion of the ladder.
Yes, so he says that, but in the scene where it's describing him, like this is after. It only explains this after it just describes him only injecting restriction enzymes.
Is it?
Yeah, that's not in that same. Here, I think I have.
Maybe.
Because it's not. Because I noticed. Because it says in it just like.
Yeah, this book has no sense of nuance between like cloning and genetic and transgenic organisms. And it's just no sensitivity to those things at all.
Because I was reading
it's
it.
It's all just bad, evil genetic experiments.
To try and understand what was the purpose of what he was doing. And in that scene, it literally just says he injected restriction enzymes.
And then watched life explode or something.
Yes.
Yeah. No, you did. At best, you did nothing. At worst, you've damaged the cell and it is no longer viable.
Page, yeah.
I thought it was there.
Yeah.
Yes. So here, this is where he's like, he injected restriction enzymes.
Yeah. So it's.
Oh, and then it does say along with the injection of foreign strands of DNA. Yeah. So you're right. It does.
But he's doing it. He doesn't seem
like
to be
totally
doing it in
random. And it doesn't.
He's like, I'll take some DNA. I'll take some out. I'll put some others in and I'll see what happens.
Yes. Yeah.
And like, do you know what either portion does?
Yeah.
Nope.
And did you make sure that the DNA that you're injecting is paired with the restriction enzyme? So it's actually going to fit in the spaces that you're cutting?
Nope.
And then my favorite was at the end of the scene. At his command, human evolution vaulted into the vast, exciting unknown. Like, really? Yes. No. You're just randomly putting things in there that you don't seem to really understand what you're doing.
I mean, it's important to know that in 1996, the Human Genome Project was nowhere near completed.
Yes.
So basically, people were kind of stumbling around in the dark about it.
Well, and I think this was the fear.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting because at the front of the book is like this. There's like this quote where he says something effective like genetic modification is completely unregulated, which is not true because actually there's tons and tons of regulations about it, and all these rules about it, particularly using human DNA that are developed right around this time to assuage those fears and anxieties. But yeah,
well, he makes some very interesting assertions in the book, like. Cloning cattle is something that's done all the time. He says that in there, like, we clone cattle all
once.
The time.
They did it once.
Well, they cloned Dolly, the sheep, which is not a cattle.
aren't sheep a type of cattle?
No.
No? Okay.
No,
sorry.
Cattle is just cows.
Okay.
But.
A school own.
But this, yeah, like, we clone cattle all the time. No, no, we don't. We artificially inseminate cattle all the time. Yes. That's a thing, but I feel like he didn't really understand the concepts that he was describing.
Yeah, well, and the whole point is like that cloning, like Dolly had in interminable health problems.
Yes.
Like, you know, I had all these issues and like cloning. You know, he's doing cloning partially as like an everlasting life thing. Like, yes, we'll just do, you know, we'll just get a bunch of replacement clones. You can lay them out on the lawn, and when you need a spare part, you just go rip it out of one, you know. Keep your clones on blocks. And then, you need a new foot, just saw one off and strap it on.
I think you're getting ahead of things, because we don't know that yet, that's his. And it comes out at the very end that his agenda the entire time was to create the technology to clone people so that then they could have a never-ending supply of organs, basically, so they could be immortal. So then you can just, as stuff wears out, you can just replace it. But none of the things that he's doing throughout the entire book, none of his projects, like trying to mutate human embryos, that doesn't align with cloning people at all. It doesn't make any sense if that's his end goal. Why wouldn't he just like start working with people's own cells and try and revert them back to stem cells, which is something we can do now. And if he had spent 10 years doing that, he probably could have come up with that technology, you know, would have been much closer to his goal.
So I'm probably going back a step here, but there's this part that I really, really like where Slater is talking to the Latin professor, Ben, and they're talking about the science. And they're like, but if he's cloning people, why is he doing it? Or how is he doing it? And Ben says, oh, the technology is already there to clone complex beings. It's now routine to clone cattle.
Yes, that we did.
Which I was like,
is it?
Is okay. It, for one thing. And then
Dolly was born like 4 months before the publication of this book. Like June 1996 is like the birth date of Dolly.
Yeah.
So Ben, the Latin professor,
somehow knows a lot about.
Maybe he talked to some cloning. Other scientist or something.
He
I don't know.
He speaks Latin, the language of science.
Yeah.
He says it's routine to clone cattle. And Slater says, why not humans then? And Ben says, I asked the same question, and this is the answer I got. How long can an embryo grow in a test tube? And I was like, okay, if you have a problem growing a human embryo in a test tube because you need to implant it in a uterus to grow to term, how are you cloning the cattle outside of a uterus?
They're not. I assume they're like cloning it and then implanting it in a cow because you can do that.
Well, yeah, for sure. But then wouldn't they do the same thing with a human?
Yes, but he's saying ethically, where are you going to get the women? That's what he's saying.
Von Cleese knows.
I guess.
I think you
end up with the same problem with...
Here, this, like, read this paragraph.
Yeah, ape blood and human blood don't mix.
No.
Only human mothers can nurture human embryos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No way
could you have a place that big involving that many people expected to remain. Right. Yes. This is where he outlines the exact thing that Van Cleese does and says, that's impossible. How would they ever keep it secret?
So can we just rewind for a minute to get to the point where
we have a Latin professor.
I don't know. I think it's very bizarre to say we're cloning cattle and then just implanting them in other cattle.
All the time. Yeah.
Like, because one, that would be super, super expensive compared to just artificial insemination, and you get the exact same
result. It was stupid.
Result.
Agriculturally, you would not do that.
No. There's no purpose to it whatsoever.
No. Why would you create, like, in science, yeah, I understand, you create strains of mice or whatever because you want to do the same. But in cattle, you want them to be diverse. You don't want to... everyone to be susceptible to like one disease, right?
That I found the perfect cow and I cloned it.
Yeah.
Oh no. Yeah. All my entire herd is now one cow.
That's a terrible
because it's
idea.
Perfect.
Yeah. It's a really bad idea. And it's just not happening. It is not commonplace to clone cattle.
I keep them all in bubbles now. It's a bubble herd. None of them are.
And it definitely wasn't commonplace in the mid-90s. To have cloned cattle.
They had done it once at this point. Maybe. It was probably written actually before they'd done it once.
Or maybe possibly. Dolly. Like, probably Dolly happened and then...
Anyway. I just thought that was... I thought it was kind of dumb to say, oh, there's no way that we could possibly have enough human hosts for cloning, but it's entirely possible that we have enough cattle hosts.
I think it was more like, it's not that the hosts are unavailable, it's just how would you convince women to do that? Like... how would you do that ethically?
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
where you get the cattle to do it, though? Like, what farmer is going to be like, sure, you can have all of my breeding cattle and fill them with clones. Please,
but you could
do that.
You could do it in a lab.
I guess.
Right, like you could do it in a research. Yeah, you could do it on a research cattle.
But I mean,
yeah,
as we find
you
out
could do
later,
it to like four.
Yes, you could do it to like four at a time.
As we find out later, really, when the women are impregnated, the joy of having a baby is just enough for them. Right?
That's why they never bothered to like organize and try and escape.
That's why the women never try to leave the institute, because once they have that baby in there, I'm just like, the mothering instinct takes over. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's also the locked door.
But they don't even try to leave because they're just
because they're so happy that they have babies.
They've had forcibly implanted in them their knowledge or consent.
Well, yeah, but they're dumb, remember. So they think it was divine.
Right, of course. They're foreigners.
But we have a Latin professor introduced into the story in the first place, because Slater kidnaps these boys and they talk in a foreign language and he can't figure it out.
First he thinks it's Spanish.
So then he phones a university and talks to someone in the linguistic department.
Yeah. Oh, and that
and
was
plays
so much
like
fun.
A recording or something. And they're like, oh, that sounds like Latin. You should talk to this guy.
Fire a bunch of people. Yeah. The struggle is real, people.
So he discovers through, however, talking to people at the university that these boys are speaking Latin.
And then he says, oh, a Latin prof. Well, here, let me just put you on the phone with these boys.
Yeah.
And that's when Del, the cop, shows up at his door.
Yeah, to try and find out how much he knows and figure out if he has to kill him.
Super Detective Del comes to...
Slater goes outside and plays his tough man, and Del says, I'd like to come inside, and Slater says, nope.
Yeah, go pee in the bush.
But I really have to pee. Tough luck. Go in the bush.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just peeing. Bush is good for that, too.
Bye-bye.
No cops in my house. So... Ellis knows his rights, so.
And then when he goes back in, the Latin guy is like, get them out of there. Get those kids out of there.
Yes.
And it's slowly...
Because apparently now they've found all of the words to describe forced confinement and... I'm not sure exactly. I'm just thinking, a minute ago, they didn't know what the sun was or how to describe... a phone call, and now all of a sudden they can be like, there's a bad man, and he captured us, and he cloned us, and he's kept us in this room, and we've never...
Well,
so like, and if I was hearing that for the... I'd assume that Slater was the bad man. I have a lot of questions, and I wouldn't necessarily tip off that I knew everything right away.
I don't think they... I think they just talk about, like, their life, right? And he's like, oh, man, this isn't normal. This is weird.
Maybe.
Right?
Maybe that's all it is, yeah.
Like,
anyway, it's like, bring them to L.A., because he's at UC... LA or something.
Yes.
And yeah, and so this through his interactions with this prof and the boys, we find out that they've been kept in this like secret science institute, and that's why they speak Latin, which is the language of science.
All scientists know it.
Yes, and all scientists only speak it fluently. And everyone in this institute must only speak it fluently because that's the only language the boys have been exposed to.
That's how you acquire language.
Yeah.
I assumed, and maybe I'm really wrong here, that this was part of Van Cleese's master plan, that if there ever was a breakout, no one would even be able to tell anybody what was going on because no one else speaks Latin.
Well, you, I think, have a much higher opinion of Van Cleese and Sigmund Brauer's ability to create.
I think I was just filling in the gaps.
I always just assume the Institute employed a lot of Catholic priests, which seems weird because it doesn't seem like something they'd be down with.
And
but, you know.
If I mean,
I don't know how many Catholic priests you know.
I mean, the boy part for sure. But.
That's all they knew.
But
we need you to raise some boys for
the
us.
The reproductive sciences. Oh, God.
I feel like if they had people that were that fluent in Latin speakers, this guy, this professor, would be on their payroll. Because how many people, are fluent in Latin, you know?
Yeah, he would be the one training everyone.
Yeah, he would actually...
Making sure
this
that they
would
get
be
their
the
conjugations
trap.
Correct.
Yeah. And then if anyone contacted him, like really Van Cleese should have set that up.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I don't know.
How do you miss that? If anyone contacts you about children speaking Latin, right? Like,
let me know. Yeah,
yeah,
I knew that thing.
He somehow had everyone else in his pocket.
I'll show
except
pictures
like,
of you at Mardi Gras.
The one person. Yeah. The one person who actually speaks Latin, you know? Yeah.
So then Slater immediately packs up his stuff,
road
drives
trip.
Out of there.
Yeah.
And just straight on to L.A. Del comes back, like, in the middle of the night in all of his, like, super secret army training gear. face painted up dark or something like that.
Totally shell-shocked, going back to psychologically Vietnam. Transported back to Vietnam.
Parks his car like at the bottom of the mountain, climbs up, hikes up there, gets into, like he's under a bush.
Goes Rambo, like full Rambo.
And hides under a tree where you can see Slater's house. And this is another, like, this is where I really like Sigmund Brauer's attention to detail. He talks about when Del has to pee, that instead of getting up to go pee, he rolls away.
Yeah.
He, like, makes two or three rolls, and then laying down, pees.
Whips his dick out.
Yeah.
Not in the direction he has to roll back again, because no one wants to roll non-pee.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he pees.
He thinks about that.
Shakes it twice, puts it away, and then rolls back to where he was, all perfectly silently, because he's an army dude.
Yeah.
It's kind of badass stuff they do.
Yeah, detail.
It's important to note that Del is being blackmailed because he was at the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and that's what he's being blackmailed with.
And his wife is also being blackmailed with Del being at the My Lai massacre.
Which is crazy because that's also like a known event. So I don't know how you can really blackmail something with like a well-documented news story for which everyone has already been investigated and then presumably charged or cleared.
Del wasn't investigated. No one knew that he was there. He got out scot-free.
So I don't know how you can blackmail someone with a public knowledge. But
I mean, it is kind of an elegant solution though that his wife and him are being blackmailed with the same information. Like, it's elegant, right?
They'll never tie.
Yeah, like the wife would never confront him about it because I don't know, she's ashamed of him now. So she'll never say, like, what did you do,
but
you
why
son
would
of a
she,
bitch?
Like, yeah, why would she stay with him then? Or why wouldn't you?
Well, because that's Del's fear, right? Is that if she finds out, she'll leave.
Yeah. What's her fear? I don't understand.
I don't get
what
it. I don't get it.
Because it's not a good, because it's not wifely.
If or you, it's, or you know, they'll men, release it to the public.
Candace, maybe men kill worried. People at war. Okay, and it's just something they got to do, and we understand it. And you know.
I think she's trying to protect his reputation.
Yes, she's worried for the shame of him. As a proper wife,
right? Yes, the these verily womanly women we have.
Can
in this
we
book.
Speaking of the proper wife? We haven't talked about Paige.
Where's
in a little
Paige?
While.
Where's
Paige? Oh boy, she's visiting a southern lawyer.
I wanted to mention that when Darby, her husband, is on the phone, he talks about how he has it all set up. He has everything set up so she's protected. So they better not go after her, right? Yeah. Meanwhile, all the stuff is happening, and she goes to visit the lawyer. Yeah. Right? She gets contacted by the lawyer somehow. Yeah. I don't remember how. And goes to visit him.
Mm-hmm. Because the lawyer just happened to see in a newspaper that he was now subscribed to at Darby's request. Darby said, like, here's $1,000.
Yeah,
subscribe
that's right.
to this newspaper.
And if you see my obit.
Yeah, call my wife.
Give this info to my wife. Yeah. So she goes to visit the lawyer and he gives her a file containing all of the information that Darby has uncovered that links the international...
World Relief Council
to the Institute.
To Technogen.
And to Technogen. And what I found amazing was that his idea of protecting his wife was literally making her the sole recipient of all of the dangerous information.
To make her the biggest target.
To actually increase the target on her. I'm like, really? This was your plan? This is how you're... keeping her safe. This is how she's protected.
And also, Van Cleese obviously has her phone bugged. So as soon as she gets the call from the lawyer, he knows, and he hires a couple of like really tough gangsters from Tampa
to follow her, either kill her or take the info, depending on
the
situation.
Make it look like a robbing or something, though.
Yeah.
My favorite part, then, this is not so important to the plot, but it's just like really lovely texture because it's like, she, of course, she's greeted by this humble southern lawyer. You know, I'm white linen suit and suspenders who takes this time to just go on a long diatribe about, but what if the South had won the war? How would America be different? Boy, yes. Men were men back then.
Yeah, he does have this weird thing. He's
what?
Like, I haven't gotten to tell anybody about this thing that I, this, like, story that I heard once. Because he hands her the envelope, she opens the envelope, reads a letter from her husband, starts to cry. He leaves the room. He comes back. And then she's like, okay, well, I have to leave now. And he says, there was a story about a guy who had some confidential information and in the Civil War.
Yeah.
And,
He gave it
to somebody else. And they knew he had it because it was in an open envelope. Now, I always wonder what would have happened if he had a closed envelope. If somebody gave him a new envelope and they'd sealed it.
That's right.
No one would have known. So here's what I'm going to do for you. I have promised that no one ever leaves this office with an open envelope. And this, of course, makes the two gangsters.
Hitmen.
think that she hasn't opened the envelope because it's still sealed.
So then they can just rob her. Yeah.
And she doesn't die, but she has all of, well, at least some of the information in her head.
Yeah.
By the way, young missy, slavery maybe wasn't so bad.
And, what? What?
And who does she decide to talk to about this? None other than John Hammond, the head of the IWC.
The boss of the company.
Who is another one of Van Cleese's...
Well, he has been very kind to her. And he is very smart.
Yes, and charming and handsome. Yeah.
She also, I really love this. Like, she's, I don't know how, she must have had a bunch of money or maybe like he had insurance or something, her husband.
They were very well off.
He made $500,000 a year.
Well, yeah, I mean, for sure. So she's got cash, but she's not in her home anymore. She's trying to sell it and just like has it up for sale with a realtor. And she is spending every night she spends in a different motel because she's paranoid now. But she always goes back to the same diner in the morning.
Yeah, that's right.
Where she again meets a very charming, humble waitress. Well, I don't know nothing about no conspiracies.
Yeah.
What?
I know why I stay with my husband, even though he's not very good.
Husband. Just live-in man.
Oh, yeah. Live-in man. Yeah. My old man. He wouldn't even marry me. But he does stick with me.
And when you're old and ugly like I am, what more can you ask for, basically?
Than someone who just tolerates you.
Yeah, that I have to do everything for, and he's kind of a bum.
And does at some point, because again, one of the things is this book really wants you to often takes the time to like make sure you know everyone's race. Do we know, does he ever talk about her race?
No. I can't recall. No, he doesn't, which makes me think she's white.
Probably.
Yeah.
That's a good assumption.
White trash, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because if there's ever a person of color in this book, he tells
you. It is.
You.
Yeah. Yeah, he makes sure you know that.
Well yes, because they have a wide, flat face. That's how he describes all the black people.
Does he?
Yeah, at some point. Also, like in the beginning, he's like...
He also says
color. She was grunting with her wide, flat, broad nose,
really?
Brown face. You're like, oh my gosh.
Oh.
My gosh. Oh. Oh. He's just, it's disgusting. A lot of it is really disgusting.
So Slater's looking after these boys. One of them has a pen with Darcy's information on it, and this is how he finds Paige. This is where they finally meet. And so
he's like, Darcy, looks up the Darcy, finds out that there's a house for sale that Darcy used to own.
Yeah.
Calls the realtor and
makes an offer she couldn't refuse.
I can't connect you to the owner. And he says, what if I pay 15% over asking in cash? Will that get me a phone call?
Yeah. And then a dinner. He goes out for dinner with Paige.
Well, yeah, because then he talks to Paige and says...
Van Cleese-esque move.
That's why they're the same character.
They are.
Full Van Cleese.
But he's also done his research on the line about Darby.
Yes.
Right? Because and that's when he finds out that he's connected. He kind of connects at least the IW thing and Technogen, doesn't he?
Somehow he does.
Yeah.
He's able to find them.
Online stuff.
Yeah.
Magically.
The internet.
Yeah, on the internet.
I really enjoy, though, that he phones Paige, and Paige is just angry at him because how dare he? And then he drops her name, like drops her husband's name, and she's like, okay, fine, I'll go for supper with you. And then goes for supper and is still just angry at him.
Why is she angry at him?
Explains it. She's just super cold and won't talk to him.
She doesn't
and then
trust
he says,
him because somebody's been like ransacking her life.
It'd just be crazy.
Yes.
That's
but
why.
On the other hand, John Hammond
I know.
Smiles at her once, and she like melts like butter, and is like,
"Is the head of the organization that her husband was working for and killed himself? Like, why do you trust him?"
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But she trusts this other guy who says, "I'm not sure about John Hammond. He might possibly be involved with something." And I just, "What do you know?" And she's like, "Never, never. I won't tell you anything. You're the worst person I've ever met."
And then she goes away and immediately phones John Hammond. And
like, yeah.
"Hey, here's this crazy thing. There's these three twin boys, like these triplet boys, and blah, 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 blah." And like literally tells him everything.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Oh, now I have the solution to all of my problems. Everything is given to me in a complete package.
I just have to kill, you know.
I have to kill everyone. Yeah.
I just have to take them all out to dinner."
So he does. He takes.
"I foresee a lot of dinners in my future."
He takes her out for dinner. And then he kidnaps her. Right.
And he says, "I'd like to take you on a plane to Paris." And she's like, "Oh, no, 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 I couldn't possibly." And he pulls out a gun and says, "Oh, no, you will."
And then he takes her to the Institute and impregnates her with one of his...
monster babies.
One of his ball sack clones.
Isn't it in Casablanca that there's a guy who's like in a hat with a...
You know, Zvon is definitely a reference to...
No, 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 I was thinking the scene with the airplane...
At the end?
No, at the end of Casablanca. Yeah. Isn't he in like a trench coat and he's got a gun and he points it at somebody?
Yeah.
That's how I imagine the scene with Van Cleef and Paige. Is like him in a trench coat pointing a gun at her and like, "Get on the plane."
"See? I'm fucking full of lead, see? You fool, you've fallen for my plan."
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
Meanwhile, he's like commissions Vaughn to go get the Latin guy and the triplets and Slater.
Yes.
And bring them all to the Institute so that he can kill them all.
And that's where Zvon makes one of his many minor mistakes.
Yeah.
That's completely not at all his fault.
Yeah.
He goes to the house of the Latin professor, and inside is the professor and two of the kids, but Slater and one of the other kids left to go get groceries.
And clothes. But he needed one kid as like a size.
Yeah, exactly. Because they were all the same. He could just try one of them on.
Yeah.
And so then Zvon has tied up the other people and left them in the house. And now he's hiding like just inside the door or in a closet or something. I imagine it's a closet and the door's closed and he's just in there breathing heavily, holding a bottle of chloroform and a rag.
Does he have like a needle or something? Is it a chloroform or is it like a needle?
It's a rag.
Is it?
It was a rag. Because he's waiting until somebody comes in, and then he's just waiting at the door, waiting and waiting and waiting. It's like, as soon as this man comes in, all I have to do is get this thing over his face and then he'll pass out. And the door opens, and he grabs the person and finds out it's a lady. And he's like, "Oh, damn."
It's a grad student come to
something
meet
like
with
that.
The professor, yeah.
Yeah.
And then his home.
Yeah. And then he looks out the door, and there's the other kid who's like, terrified.
Yeah, who had
and
just
Slater,
arrived.
Who's like just unloading the groceries, and is like, "Uh-oh."
Yeah.
And Zvon is like, hoping that he runs for the kid. Because if he runs for the kid, then Zvon could kill both of them right there.
Yeah.
But he runs Slater runs for the car, like gets
the
in.
Car.
And he's like, "Come on, kid, get in the door."
Yeah.
And like and the kid runs off. And then Zvon chases them and he's really fast and
he gets
he's really
his
strong.
Fingers caught in the door.
And yeah, he's reaching for the kid and the door closes on his hand and smashes some of his fingers. But he's Zvon, so he's kind of turned on by the pain.
Yeah.
And then he reaches through the window. And maybe he smashes the window even.
Yeah.
Smashes the window, reaches through, and one-handed on the steering wheel, pulls the car and causes it to crash. And Slater is so surprised. How can this man be so strong that his one arm is stronger than both of my two arms? Because, again, Zvon is just...
Yeah, he's insane.
Built.
Yeah.
Which, okay.
He works out
I mean,
because he has no personal life.
The Rock
of his horrible
spends
deformity.
Like several hours a day
like
working
six
out.
Hours a day or something.
Zvon seems to spend most of his day in an airplane. How can he possibly be... Like, is he just on like in the aisle, just like push-ups, chin-ups? "Sorry, guys, I gotta stay built for my job, but I also have to travel." Like, I just don't understand how he's...
If you spend a lot of time in airplanes, you spend a lot of time at airport ramadas. And every airport ramada has a gym in it, okay?
I think I don't understand how any of the villains, like him, Van Cleef, how does he run four things?
How does he have four full-time
like
jobs?
How does he a public face in three like major jobs and then do the secret shadowy institute stuff? You know, I don't know.
And somehow nobody ever puts him together.
With the university professors?
Yeah, like the university professor who's like teaching in front of
public
all these
figure,
students.
Yeah.
And no one's like, hey, haven't I seen you on TV asking for money?
Yeah.
No. That's John Hammond, my completely unrelated person.
Platonic friend.
It probably gets called about genetics on like radio programs and TV.
Yeah. Professor Von Cleese wears glasses. John Hammond doesn't wear glasses. It's a Superman.
What about Technogen, whatever his name is?
That guy has a British accent.
also he makes it, he does say that he's like really low profile in that position.
Yes.
So maybe nobody
knows
what he looks like. Yeah.
Unless you ever meet with like an investor or a partner or anything.
Yeah, because
whoa. Didn't I give you money?
Yeah, because no one in the biogenetics research field would ever meet with anyone from the biogenetics industry field.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah.
Never. There's no
crossover there.
Oh, yeah.
So somehow he's managed to keep his like professor position identity secret.
Yeah.
But basically I don't understand how either of them exist.
No.
As characters.
So now Zvon has made a huge mistake. He throws the Latin prof and the other two kids in a van and drives them back to the institute. And Slater, presumably because he has nowhere else to go, buys a couple of airplane tickets and also goes back to New Mexico to his house.
Which is fine now.
Why he would do that?
Crooked cop. Because
I think he's trying to track down... He's trying to track down... Where the boys came from.
I think
from,
it is,
yeah.
Yes.
Right?
He's like, oh, I should go back here and then we can find them. I mean, I guess if that's your plan, then that's probably fine. If it were me, though, I would go somewhere.
Try and save the one kid.
Like, I wouldn't go back to the place where I had a cop who was sniffing my trail and, like, you're probably going to die there.
Well, but all of this is irrelevant because now we're coming to just a huge Deus Ex Machina.
Well, this is where the internet comes into play.
Yeah,
the 90s internet.
Yeah, because we find out, because Slater's profession is stockbroker, so he has...
This is where we find out anything about his background.
Yes.
Yeah. Because Slater's a stockbroker, and so he uses the internet to...
Slash Superman.
To also learn everything.
A really buff stockbroker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, he goes online, and in what is, I think, one of the... hilarious. It's just a really hilariously written, but it talks about how Slater needs to prepare for cyberspace, which is great. It's just a great line.
Yeah.
Slater prepared for cyberspace. Ellipsis.
It says that like twice.
Yeah, twice.
So and then really Slater was prepare. Going
or
into
cyberspace.
He was
now entering cyberspace. Yeah.
And then he goes. And then he goes to a chat room.
A random chat room.
Military chat room?
Because once you go to a chat room, you can go to any of the various topics.
Right.
Military, but cooking.
Secret institutes.
But there's only one chat room on the internet, right?
Yeah, there's only the one.
Like the way it's described, there is one chat room.
Like you went into cyberspace
one
and
chat room
you went to the chat room.
Branches the topics. Yeah. The cyberspace chat room.
The cyberspace.
Yeah.
And everybody was just there talking about... Like military,
and what were they talking about? The thing he wants to know about. Coincidentally,
they were talking about something else. And he was like, "Oh, they sound like they know what they're talking about." Okay,
I'm gonna ask.
Are we all training state secrets? Ooh, this public internet forum. Hey, I have a question for you. Does anyone know about this one shadowy quasi-military biogenetics institute? Why, yes, we do. Here's his GPS location.
It looks like they also had a character limit because they can only type so much, and then there's an ellipses, and then another line where they finish off their thought.
Right. Yeah. It was like early Twitter.
Early Twitter.
Just they're tweeting at each other. Yeah, and their names are Hexon 2 and Lipstal 2.
102.
102.
And S3810. Oh. And then there's Ellis.
Yeah,
his handle, his web handle is his first name.
Is his real name, his last name? Yeah.
His web handle for going on to the internet to collect secret information from lone gunman type operators is Ellis. Is his first name?
Is his last name?
His last name. I'm sorry, his last name. His first name is Slater. I'm sorry. I was thinking about Archer.
I really enjoy. So somebody asked a question about, like, can I use email even though my son's in the army or like in the Navy or something? And I I want to do something faster than snail mail. And someone says, oh, yes, you can use email.
Right.
Even to ships at sea. All you need to do is go to departments, and the keyword is internet. They'll have all the information you need. It's like, what? What department are you going to? You can just search internet on a department, and they'll tell you how to email your stepson in the Navy?
I assume they mean the Defense Department. Like, you would just go on the Pentagon, but like, defensedepartment.gov.
They don't give any very good detail. He says, hello, go to departments.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, the internet. I mean, in the 90s, people did not really understand email and...
There was departments in the chat room.
Oh, okay. Oh, so they're referring you to another part. Oh, it does. This does not matter.
No. No. It's one of those things that, like, he was very worried about saying a late model 4x4, but he didn't mind talking about the internet like this. Anyway, so the internet, it's ridiculous. It's amazing. He goes on and says, I have a question. Does anyone know where there might be a military base that you could have, like, excavated out, like, a bunch of it and no one would ever know? And someone says, oh, yeah, there's one of them. They said there was, a nuclear disaster there. You could have done that. No one would know.
Here's the GPS coordinates. Here's the latitude and longitude.
He asks if there's, like, because he follows Zvon and finds the military base. And then he asks about that military base. Right, because he sees him kidnap Dell.
Right.
This book is so convoluted.
Ridiculous, convoluted bullshit. Magically, and weird Deus Ex Machinas happen.
Everyone that we've been following up until this point converges. Ends up in the Institute, mostly imprisoned, except for Van Cleese and Zvon and Slater and the kid.
Well, because Slater
he's
going
to go in and rescue them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Slater knows that they need to get grocery deliveries every once in a while, because how else could they all live down there?
Yeah.
So he finds out some trucking companies and says, which one of these actually deliver? And then he bribes a driver and says, here, I'll give you $10,000 if you take me in with you and say that I'm, like, your assistant.
I'm covering for the guy who was sick.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Van Cleese figures deduces this whole plan and is like, oh, yes, we'll lure him right in.
Right where I want him
exactly.
to come and
he's coming
my
to
plan.
Us.
And when Van Cleese talks to Slater, he's like, what, you think some worker would have put at risk their bonded status for $10,000?
Yes.
Yes?
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
They deliver groceries.
No. This truck driver is bonded. That means he has a moral backbone.
Integrity move, proto-truck driver. But, yeah.
I mean, the guy still got the money, but he did also turn him in.
Maybe he got
best of both
money.
Worlds.
Yeah. That's why you pay after Slater. Come on.
Slater
breaks in.
Well, they let him in.
Feels like a spy because he goes in and he goes down the elevator. He checks the first floor. There's nothing. Second floor. Nothing. Third floor. Nothing. Fourth floor. Nothing. Fifth floor. Nothing. Sixth floor. Nothing. And he's like, oh, damn, there's nothing. And he pushes the button to go back up the top. And the elevator goes down. And he's like, oh, what did I do?
Seventh floor. Something.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Zvon's there waiting for him. He's like, ha, you came right to us.
Yeah. And he's like, I've got a gun. And Zvon's like,
full of lead, see?
Guns mean nothing to me. And takes the gun from him.
Yeah. Or because he's like, or we'll kill Zvon. Paige or something. Yeah, something he like threatens that. Her. And then he takes him...
he takes him to his torture room.
His torture hallway with like
different
theme cubicles.
But he takes him in to see
cubicles.
Van Cleese first, doesn't
yes,
he?
Yes, and that's when Van Cleese is like...
And that's when Van Cleese is impregnating Paige.
Oh,
with
yeah.
With one of his ball science. Babies. Yeah. Yeah. There was just something about that scene that really like...
Ball babies? it's made from tissue from his testicle.
Yeah.
Which is whatever. Not his sperm. Like, unrelated tissues that he are.
Well, I mean, if you're going to create life, you need to use a testicle.
Yeah, yeah, right?
I mean,
right.
We have established that Van Cleese is Catholic, so. I assume it's a clone. So it's a clone. He's impregnating her with a clone of himself.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Jesus. Which is like, why
Van Cleese
not just.
Jr.
But why all the extra weird stuff with creating? Like, why are you creating weird
stuff?
Stuff then, if you can already clone your own balls,
like, my testicles will live forever.
Or create a clone from your testicle. Anyway, so Slater is brought into the room where he's like
proximity, right?
Where he's impregnating Paige, but just, you know, not in a rapey way, but in a
science rape.
In a science rape way, yeah. And this is the description that's given of Paige. Paige's hair was matted with sweat, her face and neck flushed red with exertion. The hospital gown had twisted around her body, a small mercy that it still provided enough cover to keep her from complete humiliation in the presence of three men. It's just like this gross, like, sexualization of her weird bondage thing, and somehow she's supposed to feel humiliated that she's been like kidnapped, and
they might see you naked, and that would be the most humiliating thing of this experience.
There would be no more mystery, and you wouldn't be like a sexy woman anymore.
Oh.
Just like disgusting.
As if any of those men should find her attractive at that point anyway, right? Like, oh yeah, so hot. But that lady who's been abducted and tied down onto a table,
like, the description
and just wearing
just
a gown.
Really, like, so sexual.
Oh,
yeah.
That's my jam.
Like, I mean, I think it's
You're bad dudes.
I think it's Sigmund Brouwer's jam.
Yeah, he seems to have some weird stuff.
Something.
Yeah.
Hoping anyone gets sued for defamation by Sigmund Brouwer.
Okay, well, we have not said that he has these.
No.
He said it seems like he might.
Hopefully the grade 7 boys from his boys only book clubs don't listen to this and we ruined their hero.
So Van Cleese talks to Slater and says, I know everything, all of your plans. The boy, you sent him to your mother already, didn't you? Well, I've got that covered. Your mother thinks you're a sicko. And then,
once we've got rid of all of you, then we'll go get him.
Yeah.
Get rid of him, too.
Yeah. And we'll kill your mother while we're at it, because she has seen my
too
experiment.
Much.
So
yeah.
Despite not knowing anything other than that there was a child in her possession, I'll kill her.
Yeah.
So
he just likes to
congratulations.
Kill people. Yeah.
Also, she lives in Canada or something, so I'll kill the entire town she lives in, because why not?
And then he's like, okay, Svan.
I'll kill all of Canada.
He's like, okay, Svan, I'm very busy and important. I have to go catch the jet. You can take care of all of this, right? And then he just leaves.
Well,
and then Svan is like,
that's enough monologuing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he gets to hear the symphony. And Svan's symphony of pain starts playing in his head, and he leads Van Cleese to his torture room.
Yeah.
His weird torture. Yeah, he's got like
his sledgehammery thing.
Yeah, he's got a hallway and it's got little like rooms in it, and each one is a different torture theme.
There's
and
only
his
two rooms.
Favorite room is the sledgehammer room.
Yeah,
it's just two chairs and a sledgehammer.
And he says, "I need you to take off your shoe. And what we're gonna do now is I'm gonna use the sledgehammer and smash your pinky toe. And if you don't move, then that's the only toe I'm gonna smash. But if you move your foot, I'll still smash your pinky toe, and then I'll smash the next toe. And if you move again, we're going to move through all those toes.
Smash them all."
And Svan is really, really good at this.
Because
even when Slater moves his foot, Svan is able to predict where he'll move his foot and still smashes his toe on the first hit. You're like, how did you do that? How can you swing a sledgehammer with such precision that as soon as the guy moves
his foot,
you are already redirecting the sledgehammer to where it's
or
his Svan, foot is going to end up.
Svan has really bad aim.
And just takes credit for
he's
it.
He's just trying to trick people to move their
feet. Nailed it!
And it's at this point where he asks Slater to take off his sock.
Yeah, so he smashes all of the...
He smashes on one foot and then asks him to take off the sock on his other foot. And it turns out that Slater has like bear spray in his sock, and he manages to spray Svan and immobilize him and escape and rescue everyone.
Well, because then the bear sprays in Svan's face,
and it reminds him of the fire that burned.
Right, that's
like,
what it is.
Gave him like the face scar.
Disfigured him.
Yeah.
And then Slater somehow is able to chain him up.
Yeah,
I was like, "Whoa, what? How did what?"
And that gives him enough time to go and explore the whole floor and rescue everybody.
Because apparently no one else works there.
Yeah. And then, but meanwhile, because he rescues Paige, but the lady who's in charge of, like, the pregnant women,
Velma,
notices that Paige is missing and goes and lets Vaughn out because they're buds. Yeah.
And Paige and
they play a lot of euchre together.
Slater went and found Dell.
Yeah.
And the
Latin guy.
And the Latin prof who were together.
And then Dell and Svan fight.
Yeah.
And
a battle of titans.
And they both
Dell's on the good guys team now.
Yes. And they end up in the other torture room, which is full of like scorpions and snakes and things.
Other venomous things.
Yeah. And they both die.
At this point, both Paige and Slater have a gun.
Or just one of them does?
No, they both do.
Okay.
Because both of them are waiting to shoot and they can't.
Right.
And then there's like a snake that comes out of the poison room.
Yeah.
And Paige shoots it calmly, one shot, right through the head.
Yeah.
And then she's like, oh, I hate snakes. Super right. dispassionate like.
Right.
And you're
that's
like,
an important line. Ooh,
she's not just like a lady. Yeah. She's also capable.
Yeah. And she really hates snakes.
It not once before this.
Which is a very Indiana Jones moment.
Very womanly.
Yeah. Is it?
It's an Indiana Jones moment. Very womanly. That's often how I hear Indiana Jones described. Very womanly.
Indiana Jones is the most effeminate archaeologist I've ever known.
You knew him.
Not Harrison Ford, the actual Indiana Jones on whom the character is based. But we're on a huge digression.
So they both
die. A couple of
days
ex machinas later.
And in the end, so Van Cleese has left, so he's not there, but everyone else kind of gets taken care of. And in the end, Paige and Slater go to visit Van Cleese to kind of like set up a sting.
Yeah.
To take him down. And
because
this is where
Slater, using his internet skills, contacted the army.
Yeah, and because he found out about like the blackmailing and the liver and
yeah,
all the other stuff.
And
that
so
happened.
He gets a general to come in and be like, "Let's go arrest Van Cleese." And the general's like, "Sure, nothing bad could happen to me as a result of this."
Well, they murder him though.
Well, yes.
Right.
As the United States Army, we can arrest people on U.S. soil all the time for no reason, right?
But they don't
or just kill
him.
Them. They just kill
just kill
him.
Kill yeah. Him.
They go in and they hold him down, and then the general
shoots
him.
So they get it all recorded. They get him to confess his whole plan, and they get it all recorded.
Because they just show up at Von Cleese's door and say, "Oh, back for more of my monologues about how I am brilliant and a list of all of my misdeeds."
Well, even though you think you've got me now, there's no way you can possibly have found out all of my secrets, and I'm still safe.
We forgot to mention the one room in the Institute that has all of the children in jars.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, Alien Resurrection also came out that year.
That really creepy room.
Yeah, so there's a room where there's just like tons of children and embryos and fetuses at different stages of development, up to like 2 or 3 year old children, just sealed in jars. And what Slater deduces is that these like older children were pushed into full jars of this preserving liquid, and then the lids were sealed around them. And that's why they all have these like grotesque looks on their faces, because they were screaming for their lives. So this guy is
I love that
like,
how
really
he deduced
evil.
It though.
Yeah, because there's liquid on the outside.
Yeah, they had labels on the outside of the jar, and they got watermarks on them.
Yeah, yeah. So just another in the huge list of all the really evil things this guy did for basically no reason. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. And he confesses that too at the end when he's telling.
Sure, I killed them, but they were abominations.
Yeah. And I didn't want to. No. He didn't want to affect their tissues in any way by
strangling them or something.
Yeah, like oxygen deprivation before or injecting them with anything.
Being encased in preserving fluid has no effect on tissue.
Right. Yeah.
Just to be a fucking asshole.
Oh, okay. And then at the very end, Slater and Paige go for coffee. And
because Slater
she's
is smitten.
Like, I might be pregnant with his child.
Well, his clone.
Well,
his
no.
clone.
Well, Slater's like, that's a bummer. I can't believe you slept with that ass. No, he impregnated me. Like, what did you think was happening when I was strapped to that table and you came in and I was wearing a hospital gown? You know. And she's like, and if I'm pregnant,
Because there's no way that I could do what he did.
And because when they're talking with Von Cleese, he's talking about science, and then Slater starts talking about how, well, science can't explain love. And she's like, your thing about love really made me realize that
I need to keep this child. Baby.
Yeah. Like, what? And this is how they bring it full circle to abortion is bad again.
And Slater's like, well, if you want to keep the baby, like,
I'll raise it with you.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I can be a dad. And she was like, let's go for coffee in Paris in 1 year.
Yeah.
5 o'clock. Don't be late.
And that's how it ends. That's the end of the book.
Wow. It was a tour de force. I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. I couldn't put the book down. I wanted to know what was happening next.
I threw it against the wall.
It was super engaging. The science was compelling. Yeah, I mean, I would read it again.
I did read it again. I didn't remember anything. So my impression of it from when I read it in high school was that he was creating super soldiers, because there was that whole military element, and I remembered it as being like about modifying people to make them super soldiers, which turns out is not at all what the book is about. But he really kind of misdirects you with that, like mutating the clones.
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Okay, and then this is the other thing that just made me actually laugh. So he talks about how he had his three control specimens, right? Which are the three boys that we know and love.
Yeah, Amadeus.
whose numbers are not 1, 2, and 3 like you would expect if they were the first and the controls, which I thought was so weird because they're like 11, 20, 32 or something. Like, what? So I'm not sure if he knew what the ending was going to be when he was writing it, or if he just was like, wait, how do I tie this? How do I end this?
Well, as a true artist, he didn't know. The story flowed through him, and the characters took him on a journey that he didn't know where it was going.
Well, I've already taken the advance from the publisher, and I can't masturbate anymore, so I guess I should finish this book.
Okay, we might get sued for defamation.
Now we're in danger.
Just like after the big reveal at the end, so much about the rest of the book didn't make any sense.
No.
Like,
none.
Yeah, none at all. It just did not fit even a little bit.
So, okay. So, I mean, overall, the book, like, there are lots of problems with the book in the writing and in the characters and in the details. Basically, every aspect of the craft of writing was lacking in this book. I think it starts from the very, very beginning. It feels to me that Sigmund Brouwer said, I need to write a book that will warn people about the dangers of
reproductive and genetic technology.
Yes.
And I'm going to include stuff on abortion that's bad. And I'm going to...
Because it's all the same, right? As soon as you abort a fetus, it's obviously going to be used for genetic and... What was your phrase?
Reproductive.
Yes.
Technologies.
That's right. Genetic and reproductive technologies.
It's a reproductive technology.
Obviously.
Yeah.
That's what abortion facilities are for, because the Supreme Court has never recognized any aspect of them as being human, so you can sell their flesh as if it weren't human flesh. He makes that point in the book.
Well, didn't you
Which
guys,
is weird.
Didn't you guys see that video that came out that was circulating a couple of years ago where they snuck a camera in and talked to someone high up in Planned Parenthood about how they were selling fetal tissues, and they edited it. And it keeps coming up on my Facebook. I know people who are very
You are related to a lot of fundamentalist Christians.
Yes, yeah, and still have friends in those circles. And the video was edited with a very specific agenda, obviously, and the implications of it are really kind of horrifying, but it's also very inaccurate, because it basically she's like, yeah, they edit it in such a way that it seems like she's talking about selling fetal tissues for different, like, for money, for
commercial purposes.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas what they're doing is they're arranging for the transfer of fetal tissue for research purposes.
Yes, yeah. And actually, these research, like the research that happens on fetal tissues, saves children's lives. Like it's, I mean, these
for sure.
These tissues are being. You want them just to go in the garbage? Like what's I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, you know. It is a weird position, I think, to hold for me, that to say, well, a bad thing happened, a thing that I don't agree with happened.
Yeah.
And so the result of that, nothing further should happen. Like,
yeah.
That should all just, we should erase all evidence of that bad thing having happened rather than
use
the outcome of that bad thing to maybe help. Do a good thing.
Yeah. They're like, it is a bad thing.
No, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying if you believe it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
Why then would you say nothing good can come of this thing that I think is bad?
Yeah. I don't understand
that. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, but I think it's part of like, I mean, in the kind of anti-abortion conspiracy world, it's because actually like abortions aren't just something that happens. There's a whole sinister industrial complex that is inducing people to get abortions.
Yes.
To create a stream of tissue to sustain a malevolent industry.
That's the belief. Yeah.
And I think it's because there's a whole bunch of other completely baseless assumptions.
Yeah, women are being pressured into getting abortions.
Of course they are.
Because there's quotas.
Purely for genetic and reproduction.
Doctors have
technologies.
Quotas. Yeah. Of how many abortions they need to perform and stuff.
So I think, anyway, that's like similar to that Planned Parenthood video, though, of like going in with bad intentions.
Yes, totally.
And to say, this is the message we want. How can we get it? Sigmund Brauer went in and said, this is the message I will be delivering with this book. How can I craft a story around that? He never said, what would be a compelling story?
Mm-hmm. Let's and explore then this technology something. And see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, this technology is bad. How can I show people that it's bad? And I think the story, you feel that in the story, that you're like, this is a very moralistic story.
And
all
it's just
the time.
Ridiculous.
It is a black forest and a honey cured having a fighting for the heavyweight title. It's so ham-fisted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think it's disingenuous to the science as well.
And I feel like that comes from his religious background. Because growing up and reading Christian fiction, it's all like that. It all has an agenda, and it's all like moralizing tales. And I feel like that's where his kind of religious background really shows through in this. And also then in little ways where he like talks about his characters starting to pray again and,
right,
you know, and singing Jesus Loves Me and...
Yeah,
and this idea of the only, soul, like he
the
really
only way they made it through was that
the idea
they believed
of the soul
in God.
At the end. Yeah, and how Paige doesn't want to get an abortion because she's a Christian,
right?
You know, like I feel like it. He really he doesn't. It's not very subtle.
No,
but and it relates again to his agenda of making Christianity like relatable to secular people. You know.
Yep.
Yeah.
I just think I don't know. Having read other Christian authors. That are just like better storytellers and more entertaining. It's a bad way to go about it, right? Like,
yeah.
C.S. Lewis introduces people to Christianity in a way that people are like fun and they swallow the medicine without even knowing, right? There's two spoonfuls of sugar.
Yeah.
And Sigmund Brauer just dispenses
agenda.
With the sugar.
Yeah.
And is like, here's your medicine, take it. It's gross, but it works.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that it does. So it's super moralizing and super icky. It just comes off feeling icky.
Yeah.
It's not about the story. It's about the message.
Yes, definitely. There is a strong agenda.
Yeah.
And it's not subtle.
Yeah.
And I think this is a legacy that has continued on till today. Because like just today, actually, I was reading.
You're talking about the legacy of Christians and their distrust of science.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Sigmund Brauer really distrusts science going into this book.
And
he says at the end, like there's an acknowledgement that he talked to some professor, I think at the University of Calgary, and all of the science that's correct is from the professor and anything that's wrong is from Sigmund Brauer. And that's a pretty standard message acknowledgement that comes in the end of science fiction books. But I think Sigmund Brauer was very distrustful of the science and very disingenuous in his presentation of it, that it wasn't sort of a realistic portrayal of science. It was always science is evil, and the way that we're doing this is a necessarily evil task. By mm-hmm. doing science, you are evil.
And I remember getting that message a lot growing up Christian circles, because I was, in evangelical circles, you know, getting the message like evolution isn't a real thing and, you know, you should be very mistrustful of science. And so I think that, I think that's very tied to his religious background. But I also remember from that, I learned like, wow, science is powerful. Right?
Like, I'm going to do biology.
Scared. Yeah. I should learn more about this.
Even the interview with the PhD candidate or whatever, Van Cleese is saying, well, we're going to do science. And sometimes when you do science, or always when you do science, it conflicts with your morals, right? And the guy's like, well, yeah, but my morals win. And you're like, but doing science doesn't
have to. Yeah.
It have to conflict with your morals.
Yeah.
And it definitely doesn't have to be conflicting with religious morals. There are all sorts of things that science can conflict with.
Yeah.
So you just...
I mean, like, it could, yeah. But the belief is that it necessarily conflicts with, right?
You're like, no.
No. No, it doesn't have to. You're making it.
I know a lot of scientists who are very moral people.
Yeah, yeah.
And often...
And there's plenty of scientists that are religious people.
For sure.
Yeah.
And because they've actually had to think about these things and grapple with them, they will often have a clearer sense of mm-hmm. their moral boundaries mm-hmm. than someone who's never come close to their moral boundaries and had to say, would I or would I not do this thing?
Yes.
Like, they have come to that point and said... Yes or no. Yeah. And like they know where that line is.
Uh-huh. And they them. Also understand what it means then
yeah.
to do that thing.
And so I think like this misinformation war about like particularly like genetic and reproductive sciences is ongoing like to this day. Like so the Christian Post put up a story on the 26th of May. And it's talking about like and the title of it, scientists create half chicken, half human embryos. Okay, so let's think about that.
So alarming.
That is a like zygote, right? Like half the genome. Is that a zygote or is that no? Zygotes are when they're fused. Anyway, what they're talking about is like two eggs. Right.
What are they talking about in the article?
Well, the title is implying that anyway. The title is implying that they
took like a human egg and injected a chicken sperm or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Which
this,
is
like weird.
Not at all what happened. What they're doing is they're cultivating some human stem cells inside a chicken egg, inside a fresh chicken
what?
Egg.
Yeah, yeah. And which is what happens is then the human cells.
Yeah.
Actually take on the characteristics of the chicken because they respond to the signaling that's going on.
Yeah.
So it's not really like a human-chicken hybrid. Yeah,
so what happens to human cells?
I mean, they divide.
They become part
and then
of the organism.
Point, yeah, and at a certain point become terminated.
I don't know. I didn't read the whole article. Yeah.
I mean, it's not really clear from the article, actually. Like, you'd have to go and look at, like,
look at the
research
so the
proposal.
The human cells are there for a little while and then...
They're always human cells. They just, like, okay, because basically I think that what they're trying to go after is the fact that, like, all mammals kind of basically share a large percentage of their genome,
yeah.
right?
And so
I think what they're trying to study is metagenomics or, like, epigenetic.
Yeah, I think they're trying to study what signals cells to differentiate in specific ways. And because we have so many of the same genes that are activated in different ways, right? Like if you take human cells and you put them in a developing chicken embryo, are those going to be triggered by the chicken signals to become chicken-like, you know, that kind of thing is what I assume is going on there. But can you bring up that article? There was a couple of lines in it that I thought were super interesting and alarmist, just the way they were talking about it. Here we go. Ethical guidelines and laws in the United States restrict scientists from experimenting with human embryos more than 14 days old, which is about the time organizer cells begin to form. To bypass the laws, the researchers grew embryo-like structures derived from human embryonic cells and then transplanted the structures into 12-hour-old chicken embryos. I'm sure that was not We weren't trying to bypass the laws. There's something else going on here. But that's it. Like, they're just these monstrous scientists who just want to... They're the Van Cleese character.
Yeah, exactly.
Evil, yeah. Random crap.
Yeah. Yeah. They just want to do evil things for evil's sake.
Ugh.
So it's still... It is. It's a really common mindset, especially among evangelicals. And I don't know other branches of Christianity. That's the only one I'm really familiar with.
Well, but. and I think you probably find it in any sort of like fun. And again, any time you have like an insular group that is trying to distrust and discredit the public discourse, to sow kind of general confusion and advance their own agenda, I think you'll find this tactic. But yeah, I think it's part of a long and distinguished history of misinformation.
Anyway, that is Double Helix by Sigmund Brouwer.
We did it.
It's a hell of a read.
Yeah, I'm sure this was as much of a roller coaster for you as it was for us. And if anyone feels the urge to read the book after this podcast, we have a copy that we would happily mail to you.
Carrier pigeon.
Yeah.
Great. So you can find us on Twitter at AssetDroid. You can also email us, Marshall@AndroidsAndAssets or SteveSteve@AndroidsAndAssets.ca. Thanks very much for listening, and we'd like to hear back from you.